Today is Wednesday, September 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump and Vice President Joe Biden squared off Tuesday in the first presidential debate.
The president has no plan.
Obamacare is no good. We made it better.
Plus, what's at risk as fighting continues between Armenia and Azerbaijan?
There's a lot of discussion about great powers being dragged into this conflict.
And the French court rules on Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden sparred over policy and traded insults in their first debate Tuesday evening, just 35 days before the presidential election. VOA's Michael Sullivan reports on the combative confrontation.
A genial start to the debate, which quickly became a heated exchange over topics including COVID-19, which has claimed 1 million lives globally and more than 200,000 in the United States. Biden blames Trump.
The president has no plan. He hasn't laid out anything. He knew all the way back in February how serious this crisis was.
Trump said he has led an effective response.
We got the gowns, we got the masks, we made the ventilators. You wouldn't have made ventilators, and now we're weeks away from a vaccine.
Biden blasted Trump's efforts to end the Affordable Care Act, also called Obamacare, which provides health care insurance to some 20 million people. Trump said the law is unconstitutional and limits consumer choice. Biden says voters can keep their private health plans under his proposed expansion of Obamacare.
They can. They do. They will under my proposal.
The exchange quickly degenerated as each man talked over the other.
Obamacare is no good. We made it better.
Trump accusing Biden of pursuing socialized medicine. Another point of contention, Trump's choice to fill a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, left vacant by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal icon. Trump nominated conservative Judge Amy Coney Barrett, launching a confirmation process when voting has already begun in many states. Biden says whoever wins in November should fill Ginsburg's seat.
The American people have a right to have a say in who the Supreme Court nominee is.
Trump responded that it's his duty to name a replacement regardless of the timing.
We won the election and therefore we have the right to choose her.
Trump campaign communications director Tim Murtaugh says he's pleased with the debate.
I think what viewers saw was President Trump, who was in command of every moment of the debate. And I think they saw a weak Joe Biden, who was put on his heels most of the time, spent a lot of time looking around for assistance from the moderator.
Analysts, including Jeremy Mayer of George Mason University, slammed the free-for-all.
When Biden spoke, so many times he would get 10, 20, 30 seconds into a coherent point, and then he'd be interrupted over and over and over again by the president. So to ask who won the debate is almost meaningless because the president made sure there actually was no presidential debate.
With round one finished, two more debates are scheduled for October. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
VOA's Carolyn Pursuti is in Cleveland, Ohio, the site of last night's debate. I spoke with her and began our conversation by asking how the campaigns responded to the debate.
I ran into Tim Murtaugh, the Trump campaign communications director, and I asked him what he thought. And of course, he said that the president won. He said it was a weak Biden, but the president was in command of the facts. I said to him, what's the best line that you think the president delivered? And he said it was where he pointed out that Biden's Democratic Party was too weak on China. And he actually said to former Vice President Biden, China ate your lunch. He said that was my favorite line of the whole debate. Now, you know, though, the moderator, Chris Wallace from Fox News, called out the president a lot for interrupting. And I asked Murtaugh about that. I said, but what about when he called out your candidate? And he kept on saying, actually, sir, you're the one that has been interrupting the most. And Murtaugh said, well, it was a freewheeling conversation, and that allows a better exchange of ideas. So that's the Republican side of things. So from the Democrats, We had the former Interior Secretary under President Obama, Ken Salazar, who is working with the Biden campaign. And he said the president was rude and he wasn't following the rules. But Biden came out of the debate, he said, showing that he cares a lot about people. He has empathy for people. And his plan for COVID shows us that he can get us out of this pandemic successfully. So, you know, I also said to him, but how does Biden continue to deal with interruptions in future debates? And at that point, the campaign has been asked pointedly if the former vice president should sit out the other two debates. And the campaign has said they're going to talk to the debate commission about maybe readjusting the guarantees, the rules.
Have the debate organizers responded to any of those comments yet?
We have heard nothing. They need to get together and kind of be what we call Monday morning quarterback for last night's debate, see how it could have gone better, and then plan for the next one. Remember, this debate was just held, oh my goodness, it was over just hours ago here in Cleveland, and the organizers are so busy tearing down all the security perimeters, getting the whole building back to a teaching facility, which is what it was prior to the debate. So they're looking towards the vice presidential debate first. And I think we'll hear from them, but probably not until later today, maybe even tomorrow, maybe even a couple days.
Carolyn Pursuti is in Ohio for the first presidential debate. Fighting between Azerbaijan and ethnic Armenian forces entered a fourth day Wednesday. This is the biggest eruption of violence since the 1994 ceasefire. The fighting has spread well beyond the borders of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave, threatening to spill out into all-out war between the former Soviet republics of Azerbaijan and Armenia. To learn more about how the situation escalated, I spoke with Lawrence Brewers, the associate fellow for the Russia and Eurasia program at the Chatham House in London via Skype. He began by saying that the conflict dates back to 1988.
So over these 32 years, it's a conflict that ended with a decisive Armenian military victory in 1994. And there were quite intensive efforts in the late 1990s to resolve the conflict under the mediation of France, the United States, and Russia. Unfortunately, these efforts were unsuccessful at that time. And from the early 2000s, what we began to see is oil and gas revenues allowing Azerbaijan, which is the party that is, you know, very dissatisfied with the status quo, to rearm. And over the last 15 years, we've seen a regional arms race between the two countries. And since 2014, a series of escalations that go on periodically. Up to now, these have been contained at 4 and 5 days of violence. But I think that we may very well be seeing a new trend, a longer and more protracted conflict. So those are the long-term drivers, Azerbaijani dissatisfaction, the inability of diplomacy to come up with a solution that squares the circle of this conflict. And then more recently, we had an escalation in July 2020 that didn't go particularly well for Azerbaijan. And I think there's also a sense that, you know, these two countries have not had a good pandemic. We're entering into hard times ahead, and there may be a sense in which leaders want to rally populations around the flag and insulate themselves from protest in the coming months.
Diplomacy is always the preferred option towards violence, and there is some concern about the violence spilling over and drawing in Russia and Turkey. So is there a viable diplomatic effort going forward that can quell the violence now? As you said, typically it's lasted 4 or 5 days. We're in that period now.
Well, yesterday evening there was a meeting of the United Nations Security Council. They have affirmed the role of the Minsk Group. This is the body with the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe that's mandated to mediate in this conflict. It has three co-chairs, France, the United States, and Russia. And I assume that they will be, you know, intensifying their efforts in the coming days. However, I think we have to acknowledge that this escalation of violence is coming at a time of global distraction with the pandemic, with US elections, and as we've highlighted, the support of Turkey to Azerbaijan. So I think it's going to be very difficult to bring diplomacy kind of back into focus. A lot depends on the outcomes on the battlefield and to what extent these strengthen or weaken the parties. I think it's going to be extremely challenging to bring the parties back to the negotiating table. In fact, yesterday there were announcements made that Azerbaijan rejects renewed negotiations with Armenia. So I think really a very deep challenge ahead for diplomacy.
What happens if Russia or Turkey become involved in this dispute?
Well, I think they are involved. There's a lot of discussion about great powers being dragged into this conflict. They have insinuated themselves into the conflict. So I think we need to clarify that. I think what we are potentially seeing is the emergence of this conflict as another regional conflict in the Middle Eastern Eurasian neighborhood, where outside powers, regional powers that are looking to extend their foreign policy influence, are projecting power and testing one another. So Turkey's involvement reduces the risks for Azerbaijan of being isolated in the event of a larger conflict. It's a big test of Russia's hitherto largely unchallenged dominance over this conflict. I don't think that we'll be looking at open Russian-Turkish conflict. What we'll be seeing is that Armenia and Azerbaijan perhaps begin to become more and more like proxies for these outside power agendas.
Lawrence Brewers is an associate fellow with the Chatham House and the Caucasus Program Director at Conciliation Resources, a peace-building organization in London. Still to come on today's program:
holding banners and calling for their loved ones to be released. The relatives of 12 Hong Kong people arrested at sea last month marched to the mainland's representative office in Hong Kong on Wednesday.
This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. Helen Reddy, the Australian-born singer who scored an enduring hit with her feminist anthem I Am Woman, has died at 78 in Los Angeles. Reddy's children announced their mother's death Tuesday evening, saying that while they're heartbroken, they take comfort in the knowledge that her voice will live on forever. Gabrielle Union and NBC have settled their differences in their dispute over her firing from America's Got Talent. Union had said publicly and in a complaint to the California Labor Board that she was taken off the show because of her complaints that the environment on the set tolerated racism. Union and the network issued a joint statement Tuesday saying they've reached an amicable resolution. This is Lizzie Knight with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The loss of biodiversity threatens the planet's habitability for all forms of life, whether it be animal, plant, fungal, or microbial. According to the United Nations, 75% of the Earth's land surface has been altered by human actions, and 85% of the world's wetlands have been lost. Life in the oceans has also been threatened. To address these crises, representatives of most of the UN's 193 member states are meeting on Wednesday for the United Nations Summit on Biodiversity. It's a forum to discuss what needs to be done to sustainably support and maintain the diversity of life and the ecosystems on which all living things depend. For the first part of our two-part series on biodiversity loss, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Skype with Columbia University professor and research ecologist Saheed Naeem. The professor is also the chairman of Columbia's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Biology.
One of the challenges of looking at life on Earth is that there's a big scale from the single plant or the single bee all the way up to what's happening at a continental level to what's happening in the biosphere. And you sort of have to scale across all those levels. So at different scales, biodiversity is declining, but declining in different ways. And each of these different ways has different consequences.
What about the biodiversity loss that most of us think of? Animals and plant species, for example.
that has consequences for things like breeding plants and animals for agriculture, or looking for genes that might have useful materials or medicines that we haven't found yet. But if you're looking at landscape level, then we have to worry about things like increases in the spread of disease, the loss of pollinator services, and the fact that the habitats don't deal very well with increasing climate variability. So fires, floods run a lot more rampant than they used to. And then if you go all the way down to someone's backyard or their farm, you'll find that the diversity of the plants, the animals, and the microorganisms is declining in just about every way you could imagine. Even if you go into the soil to look at microbial diversity, you'll find that they also are declining. So no matter what scale you're looking at, diversity is declining.
For many of us, especially in the developing world, biodiversity is simply a quality of life issue.
Yes, there are lots of studies that show that green spaces and urban environments provide for better health and better mental health as well. Children especially do much better when they're exposed to more diverse habitats than, say, more sterile habitats in urban environments. But the people who are going to suffer the most are, in fact, the people who often live among biodiversity and really depend on biodiversity. You know, at least 2 billion people in the world are poor, and we have thousands of studies that have shown that if you improve biodiversity, you improve the productivity of the system, and the second thing is you improve the resilience of the system. Whether it's plants or animals, whether those animals are livestock or wild animals, or fish in the rivers or fish in the ocean, all of that is really valuable.
Some people look at all the biodiversity loss and paint an almost apocalyptic picture for life, including human life. What's your take?
So I think opinions vary. Many of the policy platforms, like Sustainable Development Goals, or some of these things that are coming out from the United Nations, is that we're at crossroads. But crossroads means that we haven't actually crossed into the more dire path yet. But there are people who are much more pessimistic and say that we need to do something now, something drastic, or else. There is some scientific foundation for what they say. But then the others who say we're at crossroads and there's a number of things we can do, and I think the summit that's coming up is going to try to focus on this.
What do you think is needed?
More financing and more capacity building. Because if you say you're going to do something, but you don't have the money to do it, and the people who are going to do it don't have the capacity to do it, then you're not going to be able to achieve your goals. So it really depends on what people want. People actually have to say that they want their tax dollars to go to saving biodiversity. They want to buy food that comes from more diverse habitats, like eco-friendly coffee or sustainable forestry products or sustainable oil palm. But I think the other thing is to make sure that your schools actually include environment in the curriculum. The difficulty with biodiversity is that, unlike climate change, which mostly focuses on dealing with carbon and looking for carbon-neutral solutions, biodiversity solutions are much more complex. And so be aware that in addition to climate change, in addition to emerging diseases, in addition to food security, there's also mass extinction. Because if you start to lose biodiversity, you start to lose the foundation of the way the planet works. And then solving those other problems becomes much more difficult.
That was Columbia University's Saheed Naeem speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. France's highest court has rejected Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga's appeal of a decision to extradite him to an international court in The Hague. UN prosecutors accuse the former tea and coffee tycoon of bankrolling and importing large numbers of machetes for ethnic Hutu militias who killed hundreds of thousands of Tutsis and moderate Hutus in Rwanda during a 100-day period in 1994. Kabuga was arrested outside Paris in May after more than two decades in hiding. In its decision on Wednesday, the court rejected arguments to keep the 87-year-old former fugitive in France, including health concerns due to his age. The United Nations Atomic Watchdog Agency says its inspectors have been able to visit the second of two disputed sites where Iran is suspected of having stored or used undeclared nuclear material in the past. The International Atomic Energy Agency has not named either of the two sites, and it could take several months for the results of the sample analysis to be available. Iran denies ever having had a nuclear weapons program. 12 Hong Kong residents were arrested last month at sea. On Wednesday, their relatives called for access to the detainees. Reuters' Libby Hogan has the details.
holding banners and calling for their loved ones to be released. The relatives of 12 Hong Kong people arrested at sea last month marched to the mainland's representative office in Hong Kong on Wednesday. They left mooncakes, a traditional gift for Mid-Autumn Festival, near the barricades and chanted, "Return our children." The 12, of whom 10 were facing charges related to anti-government protests last year, were arrested on August 23rd for suspected illegal entry into mainland Chinese waters as they attempted to flee by boat to self-ruled Taiwan. They are being held in Shenzhen, and their families say they have been denied access to independent lawyers. The father of detainee Cheng Zi-ho broke down in tears.
I don't even know how my children are. Is this too much to ask for? My son is also a Hong Kong citizen. He pays his taxes.
Hong Kong authorities have said the 12 will be represented by mainland lawyers chosen by the detainees from a list provided by Chinese authorities, and that they have offered, quote, needed and feasible assistance to the families. China's foreign ministry has called the 12 separatists, compounding fears of many in Hong Kong about what they see as China's determination to end any push for greater democracy in the financial hub. Mother of detainee Li Ziyin.
Us Hong Kongers who are supposedly running our own city, we can't do anything. They don't respond to us, not even to our 4 requests.
In a statement on Tuesday, the liaison office said the facts related to their crimes were clear, and that people with, quote, ulterior motives were, quote, spreading rumors about the 12 to instigate illegal demonstrations.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has exercised its rights under Security Council Resolution 2231 and restored United Nations sanctions on Iran, including the arms embargo that was due to expire on October 18th. President Donald Trump also issued an executive order imposing new sanctions and export controls on more than a dozen entities and individuals that support Iran's nuclear, missile, and conventional arms-related activities. At a press briefing, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called the president's executive order a new and powerful tool to enforce the UN arms embargo and hold those who seek to evade UN sanctions accountable.
Our actions today are a warning that should be heard worldwide. No matter who you are, if you violate the UN arms embargo on Iran, you risk sanctions.
U.S. Representative to the United Nations Kelly Craft pointed out that the United States took these recent steps after the Security Council failed to extend the arms embargo on Iran.
As I have said repeatedly, when it fails, we will not. False hopes on part of the Security Council members that the JCPOA might contain Iran's nuclear ambitions do not excuse members from their obligations to reimpose sanctions pursuant to the process outlined in Resolution 2231. It is now our expectation that all UN member states will fulfill their legal obligation and reimpose sanctions on Iran.
National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien noted that the ability of the United States to snap back UN sanctions on Iran if the regime failed to live up to its commitments was key to the United States' approval of the JCPOA in 2015.
The Iranian regime has repeatedly lied about its nuclear weapons program, its archive, and denied access to international inspectors. Today's actions send a clear message to the Iranian regime that such conduct will not be tolerated. The United States is also sending an unmistakable message to the international community, those who appease and enable Iran, that they must at long last turn away from Iran's malign activities.
Rather than waste resources chasing after a nuclear bomb or regional hegemony, the Iranian regime should provide the Iranian people with what they want and with what they deserve, a thriving and prosperous Iran, said National Security Advisor O'Brien. The president has made it clear that if Iran is willing to choose the path of peace, America will walk beside it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.